on. So M and M naught are manifolds where M naught is a submanifold. And pi is a projection that takes you from the big manifold to the little manifold. I'm defining a principal fiber bundle, more or less. H is a group, in our case, a Lie group. It doesn't have to be a Lie group. In fact, with other kinds of fiber bundles, you can have a vector bundle where that's a vector space. Basically, this is the object that you want at each point of the submanifold. Okay, so the idea is that you've got some submanifold M naught. At each point of the submanifold, you've got a copy of the group H. And the projection, the projection basically takes that H to the point in M naught. So this is the basic picture. Now the conditions. Let's see. If we look at O be an open subset of the submanifold. So, you know, picture some open set in this base manifold. Let's call that the base manifold. All right, then this entire arena, the whole thing is a manifold as well. So the manifold is broken up into a base manifold and a bunch of copies of the group H. Pi inverse at O. It's what we call a rod before, right? It's everything. Is a copy of H for each point in O. But what we need is to require that to be a direct product. Has to be isomorphic to O Cartesian product with the group H. So if you take this rod, that rod is a direct product space where one direction you have the group, the other direction you have points in the manifold. And if O1 and O2 are open in M0, let's see. Then, all right, now this is like a manifold condition. On the intersection, we require pi inverse of O1 restricted to the intersection. Now, I have to think how to say this. Let me think how this goes. In our case, this is all so simple that, it's just immediately satisfied because of the way we've constructed the thing. But if you're defining a fiber bundle, what you need is in the overlap between, two of these rods, suppose these things intersect in some region. Well, what you know is that, if you've got some fiber in that rod, then you've got the same, you ought to have the same fiber in the other rod. So, in our case, pi inverse of that g is going to be the same thing in both rods. So this condition is trivial. In general, what you want in a fiber bundle is if you've got two rods that look like a direct product, then if you take a copy of some fiber in the one rod and the other rod, they need to be isomorphic. So I don't even know how to say that since it's the same thing in both cases. Let me just say it this way, that for each fiber, require pi inverse of G1 isomorphic to pi inverse of G2. So the fiber is only over any two points, say G1 and G2. We can take a fiber here, we can take a fiber there. There needs to be a group isomorphism between those two fibers. Well, we know exactly what that group isomorphism is in our case, because each of them is a leptostat. So in our case, the quotient is the projection, all right? The quotient, we can think of G mod H as a map that takes G to G mod H, which is, we've proven now, a manifold. So G mod H is the base manifold. Pi inverse of any G is just a leptostat of G. So for two points G1 and G2, we have pi inverse of G1 is a coset of G1, pi inverse of G2 is G2 of H, and the isomorphism is to take G1 composition, G2 inverse composition, pi inverse of G2 is in fact G1 of H. Right. This is G2 times H. We act on each element of that with G2 inverse, and we have a copy of H. We act on that with G1, just multiplication, really, with G1, and that gives us G1 times H, which is the other coset. So this is the set of all points G1, H,
where H is in CH. This is the set of all G2H, such as H is an element of H. And the isomorphism, we act with G1 on G2 inverse on any element of pi inverse of G2, which is the form G2 times some H, and that just gives us G1H, which is an element of the coset G1H. So because we set up the whole thing as a quotient group, we have an immediate isomorphism. Let's see. So this is a quick way of saying that what we've got is a fiber bundle. We're not going to be proving many things are fiber bundles. What we want to do is use them. This is the structure we need. What we need is a manifold, and each copy of the manifold, we have a copy of a group. Or at each point of the manifold, we have a copy of some Lie group. That's what's going to allow us to do gauging. So, any questions on the picture? Yeah, Neil.
The picture's pretty good. But I was hoping you could explain something else to me real quick. So we have our inverse projection acting on G over here.
And it
gives us G times.
It gives the coset G.
Right. That is, for some reason, is not intuitive to me. I don't know.
All right. Let's draw the picture again. We've got the manifold, which is the group quotient.
Right. R M naught.
And at any point in that, each point in that. Is a coset. GH. Right? So that's what this is. This set is defined as the set of all cosets.
Okay.
Now think of this as being inside G. So G is some whole big group.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we got the cosets is we pick individual points here, we act on those individual points with H to get the coset GH. So we're going to do that at every point of G. We find that every point of G lies in exactly one coset. So for the fiber bundle, think of this picture instead of this one. Right? G divided by H is some manifold. Well, it's this manifold lying inside of G, where we've identified this whole set as one point as a manifold. So we might as well call that point G. All right? But G is some point in the whole set. So let's suppose we identify cosets with the G that labels the coset. So if we have some G prime over here, okay, labeling the points here, there's a one-to-one correspondence with some set of labels that we've put on cosets here. So this is G prime H, GH, and so on. Okay, so a correspondence between this selection of individual points, one point from each coset, as a way of labeling the coset, and the point in this manifold. So if I want to know pi inverse of this point G here, what I mean is, I look at all points of G here, that were taken to that by the projection. All the projection does is collapse the coset to a single point. So it gives us that point G from everything on that coset. Pi inverse of that G, boom, gives us the coset back. It's everything that went to G under projection.
So let me ask a question real quick.
Yeah.
So G, in say some, if I'm allowed, if I can think of it as point space. G will be, and you have n dimensions. G is going to consist of say n minus m dimensions, and h is going to be our m dimensions. And so for each g, you'll say have 1, 2, 3, 4, and then h spans the rest of the dimensions.
The whole group spans n dimensions.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
The subspace spans. Right. If H is an M dimensional manifold,
mm-hmm.
then this manifold is N minus M dimensional.
Okay.
Right. Because for each copy of H, boom, you have just got the one point.
Okay. It's making sense.
The dimensions will just add up. And locally, this space looks like it's a Cartesian product between copies of H and points in this manifold. So you've got N minus M dimensions in the manifold crossed with the M dimensions. Here, you get an N minus M plus M dimensional
mm-hmm.
Cartesian product. That's your original manifold.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just thinking, okay, what is the example of SO3 mod S or SO2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would be a good choice for the base manifold in that case?
SO3 mod SO2.
Right.
The base manifold, I mean, that quotient is a manifold, and
right.
the manifold
right.
is S1. It's the circle.
Oh, okay.
It turns out you have to work that out, but that's
okay.
It's a circle.
Okay.
So yeah, we've got these. Let's see, SO2. Oh no! I'm sorry. It's the two sphere, right? It's a two dimensional manifold.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
SO3 is a three dimensional group. SO2 are those one dimensional fibers we carefully drew one of, and there are a bunch of others somehow threading through that ball. Right, there's a two-dimensional manifold. The set of all of those little strings through the ball form a two-dimensional set. That set turns out to be the two-sphere, the two-dimensional surface of a sphere in three dimensions. So S2. The quotients of rotation group give you spheres. You know, n plus 1 over Sn. Or SON gives you, I think that's the N-sphere, if I did my numbers right. Or something. Well, check dimensions. You can construct spheres by quotients that. Yeah, okay. Good? Other questions? Okay. All right. Now, we want to use this for gauge theory. The next step, let's see, this may be a transition point where we're no longer talking about the groups, we're now talking about gauge theory. So we're still going to look at how to write these things in a way that let us construct the essential elements of our gauge theory. In particular, we're going to get to the gauge fields first, and then we're going to use those gauge fields to build some invariant quantities. And those invariant quantities will be the fields of our theory. This is totally the reverse direction from maybe introductions I've given to gauge theory before, where you start with an action, say, for a Dirac field or something like that, and you notice it's got some global invariance, and you generalize to make that global invariance local, we're coming the other direction. We will build the local action as our first ansatz for an action. Probably can use an example about this point. Let's take a few minutes and do a gauge theory from the physics side first. The simple U1 gauge theory, something like that. And then we can construct the same thing from the other direction. To do the general construction, we're going to need to talk a little bit more about Lie algebras and another way of writing Lie algebras using differential forms. But I think probably this is a good place to break, do an example of a gauge theory before we start to build that general structure. How about it?
Pretty good.
First order time derivatives. Now, that's false, but Dirac didn't know it. All right. It's not really true. But it does, it is consistent with the uncertainty principle. Can anybody tell me why? Why do I want a first-order equation of motion, first order in time, in order to be consistent with the uncertainty principle?
Because if you got the second order, you have problems with the commutation of Tnx, because velocity is first order in time.
You're on the right track. The commutator of Tnx gives rise to the uncertainty principle, which says that I can't know both position and momentum with arbitrary certainty. If I have a second order equation in time, how many initial conditions do I need? Position and velocity. I can't have that in quantum mechanics. I'm not allowed to. So by restricting to first order and time derivatives, I can get by with one initial condition, and I can have that. So it gives me at least a plausible quantum mechanics equation. Something I can actually hope to solve. So the Schrodinger equation, Schrodinger worked very hard to get first order time derivatives in the Schrodinger equation. The problem with the Schrodinger equation is it's not relativistic, and Dirac would like Schrodinger. The Schrodinger knew this too, but Dirac wanted to insist on the equation being relativistic. If it's relativistic, it must treat space and time on an equal footing. It can't be, if you have ddt, you also have to have, just graph. You can't have higher than second spatial derivatives and keep it linear in time and have it relativistic. So it's got to be linear in derivatives. Okay, so he needed some further constraint. So what he said is it should imply the Klein-Gordon equation. The box of the wave function should be m squared c squared over h bar squared times the function. So, this is a nice wave equation for something like an electron, where so this has plane wave solutions that look like a e to the I over h bar p dot x minus et, where those are the relativistic energy and momentum. If you take Bach to that, you get basically e squared minus p squared, which is going to be m squared. Up to so you've got to have this term on the right in order for a plane wave that depends on the relativistic energy and momentum of the electron. This is a good starting point. I think I ran through this in quantum.
Yeah,
got Schrodinger equation by taking sort of a square root of this thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what Dirac did. Combination of derivatives. Let's see, I think it helps to put an I here. It doesn't matter, that's actually a convention. But if I look at this acting on my wave function equals zero, it's first order in the math, it's linear in derivatives. Okay, so this is just the sum of the four space-time derivatives. And our goal is to figure out what the gammas have to be in order for this to give the Klein-Gordon equation. So we've made it first order in time. We've made it potentially relativistic. To find the Klein-Gordon equation, I can act on zero with let's take the conjugate. Let's see, do I want the conjugate here? I think the conjugate works fine. I gamma nu d nu minus m. Let's see, is that? Yeah, that would be nice. I gamma mu d mu minus m. That has to be zero. I want this to turn into the Klein-Gordon equation. I want this to be box minus m squared phi. Right. So, Klein-Gordon, let's C and H bar be one. Just choose units, so C and H bar are one. Then the Klein-Gordon, that looks like the Klein-Gordon equation. Well, I want this to be the Klein-Gordon equation. So what I get is gamma nu d nu gamma mu d mu. Then I get a minus I m times that contraction and a plus I m, so the cross terms go away, and then I get plus m squared all acting on psi equals zero. So this thing gamma nu, I want these to be constants, just constant parameters, d nu, d mu. That I want to be the same as minus the D'Alembertian. I guess the minus is there because I chose I the way I did. There aren't numbers that do that. Right? These gammas cannot be just some constant four vector and have that happen, because we're going to get off diagonal terms. Right? This has to be d squared d t squared plus or minus del squared. And it's not. Unless this thing, I need the gamma nu, gamma mu. Well, notice partial derivatives are symmetric. So I can write the symmetric part of this, gamma mu, gamma nu. If that symmetric part was equal to minus the Minkowski metric, that would do it. That's really what's required there. And what that says is that the anti-commutator of gamma nu and gamma mu has to be equal to minus twice the metric. That cannot be true for numbers, but it can be true for matrices. So we choose matrices. Gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3 with this property. This is not a matrix. That's just for each mu and nu, that's just a number. So we better understand there to be an identity matrix here. Yes, Neil.
Okay, I'm sorry. how did we go from our negative box equals yada 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 to the next line?
These partial derivatives commute, right? So so this is equal to its symmetric part, right? And I can induce that symmetric part onto here. So this can only be a statement about what the symmetric product of these gives.
Okay.
Right. This is the same as half gamma mu gamma nu plus gamma nu gamma mu d mu d nu. Just because those partials commute.
Right. Yeah.
So the only thing I can include is something about that symmetric bit. What has to be true is the symmetric bit's got to be proportional to the Minkowski matrix.
Because you're going to see T minus
We've got to get this. So we've got to get that.
And
back.
That's why that's where the eta.
Yeah. This is minus eta mu nu partial mu partial nu. I can write the box that way.
Okay. I can see that now.
Good. Okay. Any other questions?
So these are going to be 4x4 matrices or 4x1.
4x4. They're matrices.
4x4.
They're square.
Okay.
Square matrices.
Square. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very rare to deal with anything that's not square.
I'm trying to think of a way to make it with not square matrices when it's working. So
And they have to be at least 4x4. You can try this with 2x2s or 3x3s. You can't do it. It's not too hard to convince yourself that 4x4 is the smallest that will work. They can be complex, but they've got to be matrices. Here's one. One choice that works, if I take gamma I to be I times the Pauli matrix gamma I, like that. So, imagine it divided into 2x2 sub-matrices. So it's a 4x4 matrix with Pauli matrices times I in the corners. Those square to minus 1, which is what we need here. So the anti-commutator of those work, and then let's see, for gamma 0, let's see, it's going to have to square to plus 1. I think this one will do it.
That would be the same.
And it anti-commutes with that, it squares to 1, so that should be okay. And you can check, right, gamma I with gamma j, if I take two of these, two different Pauli matrices, what I get is the anti-commutator I sigma I sigma I sigma j, I sigma j, plus I sigma j, I sigma j, I sigma I. And if I multiply these, I get minus sigma I, sigma j, and 0, and 0, and minus sigma I, sigma j. And then here, I'm going to get minus sigma j, sigma I, 0, 0, minus sigma j, sigma I. But now this is just minus, but sigma I, sigma j, plus sigma j, sigma I, that's the anti-commutator of the Pauli matrices, which is the Kronecker delta. They anti-commute. So I'm going to get an overall minus, and then if I equals j, I get the identity matrix. If I is not equal to j, I get 0. So I get a Kronecker-J and the identity 4x4. So it works for the three spatial ones. Then up here, notice that gamma 0 is just twice this thing squared is twice the identity. And we just need to check that...
you might need to change your sign on that.
Gamma 0... Well, I've got a minus here, and eta 0, 0 is a minus 1, so I want a plus 1.
Oh, okay.
I've got a funny sign convention going here for some reason. But it's just a matter of how I defined this in the first place, that I does it.
Leave it.
This is gamma I. Okay. I'm going to get something like this, because instead of gamma J, I'm going to have the identity matrix. So I'm just going to have sigma I's and sigma I's again. Oh, wait a second. That's the same. So I need a minus sign somewhere. How about there?
Will that do it?
Yep.
Now we got it? Now we get zero.
Let's see, because, and then it could be minus two times. Yeah,
I got that part. But, okay, here, let's just see. I have 1 minus 1 times I, sigma I, plus I, sigma I, 1 minus 1, and the plus. That's, okay, here I'm going to have minus I sigma I up left. Here I'm going to have plus I sigma I. And then in the lower right corner, this second column is that, and I get I sigma I on the first one. On the second, this minus hits it, and I get minus I sigma I. And so it's zero. I don't know if your camera will capture all of that, but just checking. Does everybody see it? So that's one set of matrices that satisfies this. There are infinitely many others. So once you find one set that does it, it's easy to find a whole bunch of others that also do it. But all we need is one set that does it. And you can show that this whole structure goes through quite independently of what we choose for the gamma matrices. Now, the next thing that Dirac realizes is that if those things are 4x4 matrices, so we get I gamma mu C slash minus M, I gamma mu D mu minus M on psi equals zero. Okay, that now implies the Klein-Gordon equation, so psi has to satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation in addition to this. But now it's first order in time, and he can quantize it, and he did, and everything was cool. The one thing he recognized, though, is since these are 4x4 matrices, what kind of an object is psi?
That's the four.
It's a four-component object. So you get psi is a complex four vector. Called a spinor. So he introduces this four-component spinor to describe a fundamental field. By studying the properties of solutions, he was able to show that these first two components behave like the spin-up and spin-down components of the electron. Further, he was able to show that mu and nu behave like spin-up and spin-down components of a particle with the opposite charge to the electron, a positively charged particle, but with two spin states too, same mass as the electron, opposite charge, same two spin states, he called it the positron, and this was the prediction of the antiparticle of the electron. And in fairly short order, it was discovered and Dirac duly honored. It was a great prediction. A phenomenal prediction.
He didn't get it first.
What's that?
He really didn't get it first. He didn't know how to interpret that at first. He didn't know how to interpret that at first.
How do you interpret?
He didn't know how to interpret it.
You know, it probably took him years to figure out how to. I don't know how long. Do you know how long it took him to figure out what that was? What you need to do when you quantize this is. You can, you know, from these operators, you can construct the Hamiltonian, which gives you the total energy, which tells you what the mass states are. And it you can also construct a charge operator that tells you how it responds to electromagnetism. And you'll see that it has the opposite charge. Solutions to this equation look very much like simple harmonic oscillators. You have creation and annihilation operators for this, just like really most fields. And you know, from those operators, you build, like I say, the Hamiltonian and the charge operator. Okay, other questions about Dirac theory? I mean, there's lots that we could go into with the consequences of this equation.
Has it already been interpreted that alpha and beta could represent the electron, and or this Dirac was the first to...
No, Dirac was the first. Well, okay, now, spin up and spin down electrons. There's the Pauli equation, which is the Schrodinger equation with a two-component spinner. So a two-component spinner equation had been written where it was simply a matter of representing spin up and spin down as two components of a vector. And I think there was really no theory underlying the reason for that, but there was the Stern-Gerlach experiment that showed you had these two different spins. And so the Pauli equation was probably a phenomenological statement to include that effect and include the energy of interaction of the spin angular momentum and consequent magnetic moment of the electron with a magnetic field. So by putting a little two-column vector into your Schrodinger equation, you can now have that interact correctly with the magnetic field and get torques on the thing.
But nobody was talking about antimatter until now.
No. No, the antimatter came with the Dirac equation. This was in the 30s, early 30s, I think he wrote this down. Schrodinger wrote his equation in 27, so pretty shortly on the heels of Schrodinger. Schrodinger wrote down the Klein-Gordon equation first, and then made it non-relativistic so he could get it linear in time. And Dirac figured there must be some way to make a corresponding thing that makes it relativistic. And so he forced the solution by figuring out what you had to do to make it work. And it led to an important prediction. So, the Dirac equation, this follows from this action. If I vary phi bar in this action, did you get that picture lower? Let me work from this board again. So I've more or less defined these things again here.
You got this one? Or that board? Or no?
Okay. I want to read.
Okay. Are we going to develop this from this side?
Yeah, I want to vary the action for you.
Oh, so that is...
That's the Dirac equation there.
Hey, that's cool.
I just want to show you that you now get it.
What's the question mark about?
This is the point I was asking you. If these are 4x4 matrices, what's that? The answer is that it must be some complex four-dimensional vector, which Dirac calls a spinner. And the rest
is right.
Okay. So there's lots that we could say about these things. In general, if you have some matrices whose anticommutator gives some symmetric matrix, it's called a Clifford algebra. And this is something that we might come back to and talk about. We've talked about the orthogonal groups, the Lie groups, and we saw that SU2 is actually a slightly bigger group than SO3. That's a general property of the orthogonal groups. All of the orthogonal groups, SON, can be covered 2-to-1 by groups called spin groups. So spin N is the covering group of SON. And in general, there's a 2-to-1 mapping, the same way there is between SU2 and SO3, between those spin groups and the orthogonal groups. And so the complex n-dimensional vectors that spin n acts on, or they're not n-dimensional, they're bigger. But the complex vectors that those spin matrices act on are called spinners, and so we have spinners for every dimension. And we can look at their properties in general. But let's not do that today. If I vary phi bar in this action, it's way too trivial because I get the variation of phi bar, I d slash minus m phi, and I set that to 0, then that will be 0 if and only if I d slash minus m phi equals 0, and that's the Dirac equation.
Below,
to the
other one.
Yeah, I can also vary psi and demand that be 0. That gives me d4x, now phi bar, I d slash minus m del psi. And right now I have to integrate by parts. So let's be a little careful here. We have phi bar. This is I gamma mu d mu minus m del phi. These derivatives are derivatives of the variation now. But if I integrate by parts, I'm going to pick up a minus sign. So I have minus d mu phi bar, and then I have times I gamma mu, summed on I gamma mu, and then we have minus phi bar times m del phi. M is just a constant. So that equal to 0 can be the case for arbitrary variations del psi if and only if canceling is fine. I d mu phi bar gamma mu plus m phi bar equals 0. And that is the correct conjugate of the Dirac equation. If you take the adjoint of this operator and let it act on phi bar, you get the same thing. It's also the reason that this phi bar has a gamma 0 built into it. In order for this equation to be the true conjugate of that equation, you need that gamma 0 in there. But all that does is shuffle the components of phi bar appropriately. These two equations are equivalent. So you get those. Let's see. There's some shorthand notation for this. Sometimes this is written as I d slash plus m with an arrow to the left, acting on phi bar like that, equals 0. You'll find as you continue your study of field theory that there are lots of shorthand notations for gamma matrices in this kind of equation, because all of quantum electrodynamics and all of quantum chromodynamics is built out of spinners, and gamma matrices are all over the place. And you develop some very handy rules for dealing with them. Okay. So this is the way to describe a free electron. Gauge theory gives us a way to figure out how that same electron will interact with electromagnetism. If we perform a gauging of this theory, here's what happens. F has a symmetry, has a global symmetry, U1 symmetry. So if I replace psi by e to the I times some constant angle times psi, then phi bar gets the conjugate of the angle. And if I substitute those into the action, S of psi, psi bar, goes to S of psi e to the I, phi naught, psi bar, e to the I, phi naught, with a minus. You can see it immediately just looking. If I multiply this by e to the minus pi, phi naught, and that by e to the I, plus pi, phi naught, the phases just go away and we end up with the same thing. So the action is invariant under a U1 transformation. Remember, U1 is a lead group, e to the I phi naught is a general element of that lead group of 1x1 unitary matrices. The inverse is the dagger, well, obviously enough. Very simple group. Gauging, in this sense, is the process by which we generalize to local U1 transformations. So, psi goes to psi e to the I phi of x and z. We allow phi to be an arbitrary function of position and time. And we modify the action to be invariant under that more general transformation. Now, this action is not invariant under that transformation because this derivative is going to hit e to the I phi and pick up derivatives of phi. So we have to generalize the action, and we do it by generalizing the derivative. Okay, the place we always run into trouble when we take a global symmetry. A global symmetry is the one where you do the same transformation at every point. A local symmetry is one where you can do different transformations at each point. Same type of transformation, but a different phi in this case. Anytime we make a global symmetry local, the problem is going to be where we have derivatives. If there are no derivatives, it'll probably still be invariant. Right. If there wasn't some derivative sitting inside here, then I could multiply by e to the phi, e to the minus pi phi, and they just cancel, just the same. It's the derivatives that cause the problem. So we need a new derivative with d of psi, and if I take, let's call it d, such that d prime of psi prime is d prime of e to the I phi psi, has to be e to the I phi times the old d of psi. Right. That's the property we need. And I hope it's clear that if I had a capital D flag sitting here and did that transformation, the e to the I phi here, the transformation of that derivative combined to bring the e to the I phi to the left in that derivative term, and it'll cancel the e to the minus I phi here. So, the argument is this. Does it, if we have psi bar I d flash minus m psi, that's going to go to e to the minus I phi psi bar I d flash prime minus m e to the I phi psi, and that d flash, right, the m term is fine, the factor just goes away, but with this property, d prime of e to the I phi psi is just e to the I phi times d. And now the factors cancel, and that's equal to f, and we have our invariance. So that is the property we need. That property is called covariance. This is called a covariant derivative.
Right.
How do we write a derivative that has that property? We can do it just by adding a new field called a gauge field. So we take capital D equal to that partial derivative plus our gauge field. We'll call it A. And we'll insist that A transform in a way such that we have covariance. So, migrating erasers again. Let mu equal partial mu plus I a mu. I think the I will work out right here. Where a mu is a gauge field. It's just a field. Depends on position and time. Then we demand covariance, and that takes the form in this case that d mu prime of phi prime, which will be d mu plus I a mu prime, the partials can't change, just the a, of e to the I phi phi, we demand that that be the same as d mu of, needs to be e to the I phi d mu of phi. So we write out the condition. Taking these derivatives, we have I d mu of phi e to the I phi psi plus e to the I phi d mu phi plus I a mu prime e to the I phi psi must equal e to the I phi d mu phi plus e to the I phi times I a mu phi. Just writing everything out. And we notice that two of these terms match. Just drop out. Then I can cancel the exponential in all of the terms, in fact. And let's see, what we have is I a mu prime times psi has to be equal to I a mu psi minus I d mu phi psi. This has to be true for all psi, and so we recognize a mu prime has to be a mu minus the gradient of that function phi. So that is how A has to change in order for our derivative to be covariant. Now, one thing that that means is that A is not directly measurable, because when we do this gauge transformation, this local gauge transformation, it transforms inhomogeneously. So it's possible that we could have an A in one gauge that actually turns to zero. If A itself was a gradient, then we could find some choice of phase where A is zero. That can't be a particle, because we can't do a gauge transformation and have a particle suddenly vanish. However, there is something we can construct from A. Notice that if I take the curl A mu, d nu of A mu minus d mu of A nu, let's call that, for example, F mu nu, then F mu nu prime is equal to d nu A mu prime minus d mu A nu prime, which is d nu of A mu minus d mu phi minus d mu of A mu minus d nu phi. Right, I get the old F mu mu nu. Then here I get a second derivative d mu phi. And here I get plus the second derivative d mu d nu phi. And because partials commute, that's the same. And this curl of A, this four-dimensional curl of A, is independent of gauge. So the curl of A can represent something physical. And in fact, we know of something physical that takes that form, the Maxwell field tensor. So that's the interpretation we give this. We interpret A as the vector potential as the electromagnetic vector potential and F mu nu as the Maxwell field tensor. Then since F is gauge invariant, we can add terms in F to the action. So here's what we do. We let the new action, maybe we should call it F tilde, now it's a functional of psi and A, the integral d4x of what? Well, we have now our covariant Dirac equation with the covariant derivative, and we can add a term it's got to be a scalar, so I better take F mu squared. And if psi is zero, then I can vary that and I get the vacuum Maxwell equation. This is the action. This is the action for the Maxwell equation.
We've seen that before.
Yeah, it's quite possible. If I write this out, we may have written that down before. Notice that I have id slash minus m psi, and then I also have D has an IA, so there's going to be minus psi bar A slash psi as well. This is part of the covariant derivative. The D slash has an A slash in it now. And this I with an I and the A gives us just A minus A slash. And then a quarter F mu nu. Well, if I vary psi, then what I'm going to get is a modified Dirac equation that's got an A in it. So it's easy to see that if I vary psi bar again, I'm going to get I d slash minus m psi equals 0, which means that the Dirac action, and then this term, minus A slash acting on psi equals 0, this gives the effect of the electromagnetic field on the evolution of the electron field. So this is how the electron couples to electromagnetism at a fundamental level. If I vary A, what I'm going to get, varying A in the Maxwell part, I get the divergence of the Maxwell field. Normally that's equal to the current. I think we've worked through that. But now I'm going to get this term. Without the A, I just get psi bar gamma nu phi. So this is the current provided by the electron field. And there are other ways to show that. You can use the Nitze theorem to show that that, in fact, is what you expect for the electron current, for the electric current of the electron field. So we've derived not just Maxwell's equations, but we have a fundamental source at this point. The source is provided by that fundamental Dirac spinner that describes the electron quantum mechanically. And we can quantize the whole thing then. So what happens when we gauge is that we are forced to, by enlarging the symmetry, we're forced to introduce new fields. Those new fields then contribute some new physical fields in addition to providing the gauge invariance. And the new physical fields will be fields that produce a force between particles. All known fundamental interactions can be described by gauge theory, by introducing gauge fields in the same way that I've introduced A mu here. And so it gives us a unified context for talking about fundamental interactions of nature. We're looking for a gauge theory. And once we know the symmetries or symmetries associated with the fundamental interactions, we can proceed to apply this sort of procedure to calculate exactly what the field equations are. Then there are techniques for quantizing those field theories, and we can make predictions about what happens. So, the next step is to take this structure and merge it with this fiber bundle structure that we've built. What we're describing is a set of fields on a fiber bundle. Here's where it goes. Okay, our fiber bundle, we've got a base manifold. This is space-time. At each point of space-time, we have a U1 fiber. That represents our ability to choose this phi anywhere in U1. So it's a copy of U1 sitting there at each point of space-time. So that direct product of space-time with U1 fibers is the fiber bundle we have in this case. It's a it's a five-dimensional manifold. The whole fiber bundle is some five-dimensional space. Well, so what we know in the back of our minds is, oh, if I had chosen the right five-dimensional group, I could have constructed this object at the outset by taking a quotient by the U1 subgroup, and it would automatically build this structure for me. And then if from the group I can see what fields are involved, I can handle a great deal of what I expect in this gauge theory by knowing things about that five-dimensional group. This is basically the approach we're going to take. We're going to say, okay, let's take this group, take such and such a quotient, whatever subgroup we divide by is going to be the local symmetry. What we have left is going to be a manifold that will be the physical arena. Usually space-time, but it might be something more general. In bipartite space, it's something eight-dimensional. It could be bigger than that. You can write theories where it's any dimension you want. But the theory not only gives you a way to construct this group at every point structure, but it gives you a way to construct space-time itself. Right. Space-time itself is this collection of cosets. The manifold is given to you. The relevant fields come from the choice of group. So if you have a notion of what the relevant physical symmetry you want in a physical theory is, then these gauge theory tools actually allow you to construct not just the interacting fields, but the entire physical arena, space-time itself, as part of your gauge theory construction. And that's why we've spent so long talking about differential forms and Lie groups, because we want to construct our physical arena as well as some, like a U1 or an SU2, SU3 local symmetry. Well, we also want to be able to produce a curved space-time manifold so we get general relativity. That takes the rest of this structure. That takes this quotient structure to really do it right. So it makes a lot more sense to start from the perspective of some group that's big enough to contain the whole thing, take the right quotient, see what you get, and start to interpret that then as your gravitating space-time. Now, there are a couple other steps that are needed to make it gravitate. Here we just said, we're going to stick a copy of U1 at each point of space-time. It doesn't work for gravity because gravity affects the shape of this manifold. And so we need to see what equations govern the whole encompassing group and how we can imbue those with the structure that will give us that curvature. And those are our next steps. We can start in this, if you want. Yeah, question.
So I was wondering, has it been figured out how to put gravity and some of these things together?
Sure.
Like no problem. Same manifold?
Yeah, choose a big enough group. Choose any group that contains the Poincaré group and SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, and you've got a unified model.
We just need to be able to quantize it.
Yeah, quantizing it can be a real trick, too. There are some powerful theorems that limit the predictivity of just choosing a random group that does it. There are some subtleties that come into the choice of the overall gauge group. One of the problems is that unification is a procedure where you choose your fiber symmetry big enough to contain the standard model. All right. So for most of the 70s, the standard model was thought of. I mean, people look at more general things, but SU3 across SU2 across Q1. The strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces. And it's not hard to find groups that are big enough to contain all of those. The smallest you could do, the most efficient way to do it, is SU5. It's obviously big enough to contain an SU3 and an SU2, but actually there's one more diagonal element that gives you a U1 that sort of slips by at first notice, but it's in there. And so you can build a unified model of strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces by writing an SU5 gauge theory. Well, here's the benefit of doing that. If you take a general SU5 gauge field, well, what does that mean? You know, what we're going to do is, you know, we've got some group generators, and for SU5, a runs from, how big is SU5? It ought to be like
SU5
two to the fourth 16 generators to SU5. Let's see, it ought to be the number of 5x5 Hermitian matrices. How many of those are there? All right, the generators will be 5x5 Hermitian.
For the edges.
Anti-Hermitian, that's right. Multiply by I. but Hermitian, you know, we've got reals down the diagonal, and then we've got alpha, beta, mu, nu, gamma, delta, sigma, rho, tau, lambda. So we've got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 complex numbers. So we have 20 degrees of freedom there, and then 5, so that's 25 dimensional group.
That's
big. Is that right? Yeah, you got to work a bit to exponentiate that. But the gauge field.
Yeah, 25 dimensions.
Let's see. 20. Let's see. 8 and 3 is 11. It seems too big somehow. I should be right. So the gauge field.
What is the special sense? That might restrict something over there.
Oh, yeah. Okay, special. Well, that's going to take out the one.
Oh.
Or two. Well, two. Yeah, special for a complex group. You take out the 23. That's a weird number. I think the unitary groups are like 2 to the. Is it 2n? There's a 2 and an n and a minus 1 somewhere. I can't think where they go. All right. Never mind. We can count how many elements are in unitary groups. But the gauge fields, there's one gauge field for each symmetry. All right. You notice here we added a vector field, and we had a U1 symmetry. We had a one-dimensional Lie group, and we had to add one space-time four-vector AMU. Here, we're gonna add one gauge field for each generator, and each of those will be vectors. So, in fact, you can think of the, 12. All right, to our unified theory, we have 8 gluons, that's our SU3. We have 3 weak intermediate vector bosons. That's the W plus and minus and the Z naught particle for SU2. And we have 1 photon that's our U1. So that gives us 12 generators. But in fact, we're introducing. Since it's special, you know, that gives us 23 degrees of freedom.
Let's see. 2, 4, 6. Now I've got 1, 2, Q.
Is it
23
or
24? 24 would be nice, but the tracelessness is... Traceless Hermitian. Ah, traceless, they're real. Okay, 24, good.
That, yeah.
There we go. Yeah, because they're already real.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, so we have 24 fields, 12 of which are accounted for by the standard model. And right, you can think of an SU3 generator being in one corner and an SU2 in the other corner. And there's one diagonal element that is, you can think of as being, let's see, you know, if it's 1, 1, 1, then we can have -3/2. Okay, that's a diagonal thing that commutes with both of these. All right, the SU3 is traceless, the SU2 is traceless, so the trace pieces can be added together into a generator of the U1. So that's where the U1 fits in. This whole thing is traceless. It commutes with both of those, and it doesn't line. So it's a tight fit. Now that leaves 6 complex fields here and their conjugates down there. These are called X's and Y's, and they're called generically they're called leptoquarks because they can cause a quark to decay into a lepton, an electron, or a muon, or something. That's not allowed within the standard model, but within a unified theory, you end up predicting new particles. As the other 12 generators, right? 6 complex fields, that's 12 new particles you've predicted. Each of those particles can change like a red quark into an electron, or a blue quark into a neutrino, antineutrino. There are a bunch of combinations. They do similar things. You predict these particles, and the theory ultimately gives those X and Y particles very large masses so that we wouldn't expect to have seen them yet, because we haven't ever seen these quarks decay into leptons. So as part of the theory, you need to make sure that masses are given to the gauge field in such a way that it's consistent with what we've actually measured. And a lot of work goes into actually predicting what those masses should be and why, and there's substantial progress that's occurred on that. Well, one problem that occurs with gravitational gauge theories is that there's a theorem, the Coleman-Mandula theorem, that says that if you have a sensible relativistic field theory with a local symmetry that includes the Poincaré group, so you can gauge it and get gravity, and includes, where that Poincaré group is a subgroup of some bigger group, just like SU3 is a subgroup of this SU5, you'd like to get gravity out too. It always occurs as a direct product group, not as a simple group. And the problem with that is you actually don't have any particles over here. You just have the direct product of two groups, not the groups embedded in some enmeshed way. And so you don't actually predict any new interactions between gravity and the other fundamental forces, which isn't necessarily a problem, but it says that finding some unifying group that shows that all of the fundamental interactions are different aspects of a single force falls down. You're really just pasting together the groups you've got. So you could take Poincaré across SU5, but it's no better than, doing SU5 in curved geometry and leaving it at that it doesn't predict something new. Yeah.
So, but shouldn't... I've always thought gravity is the arena where this thing happens, so shouldn't the... when you break down into gravity, you should be able to break that down lower instead of having a, something that contains both, but like has the breaking down of gravity actually contain this? Does that make sense?
Well, if you had gravity in some higher dimension, you
higher
could do that. But you don't want to break down gravity because we observe it classically, right? I mean, the properties of Poincaré gauge theory are things we observe macroscopically. That's general relativity, well tested. You know, it's there, and it's there with the full local Poincaré symmetry. So you don't want to break that symmetry further because it's not broken. We can measure it. We know that symmetry's there. Because we can rotate stuff and it doesn't matter, for example. So the Coleman-Mandula theorem is one of the things that led to supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is a way around the Coleman-Mandula theorem. It's actually possible to write a supersymmetric gauge theory where gravity and the other interactions actually mix non-trivially. And that's one way to do it. Let's see. String theory seems to do it in a whole other way. String theory has the Poincaré symmetry in it in a fairly alarmingly mysterious way, but it's in there, and you do get a quantum theory of gravity out of it in a way that gives you a unification. It gives you a large internal symmetry, E8 cross E8. You know, think of Gareth Lisi's work on E8. Well, you know, okay, it's big enough to contain a standard model, no problem. String theory also has gravity. The E8, let's see, well, in string theory, you don't need to get your gravity from the E8 because you've already got it from other string properties. So, let's see. Next step, I'd say, is to go back and look at Lie algebras in a slightly different way. I want to write you the Maurer-Cartan equation for the Lie algebra. Everybody tired? Juan's going to die over here. Questions? How you doing?
What was the name of that theory? The Coleman...
Coleman-Mandula. M-A-N-D-U-L-A.
C-O-L-E-M-A-N.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see.
Where were they?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Yeah, I don't remember. The paper came out... Let me think. I think it would have been in the 70s.
And that was the beginning of supersymmetry?
Well, you know, supersymmetry was actually introduced in the late 60s one of the first was Nambu. You know, some people, you know, Les and Zunino, were exploring the possibility of a symmetry that mixed bosons and fermions. Nambu found some situations where that sort of thing happened in superconducting situations, in condensed matter physics. Nambu, remarkable guy, just got the Nobel Prize, you know. He also wrote down the first string action, the Nambu-Goto action for string. The idea, which really still bears up pretty well, is that if you have two quarks held together by the strong force, you can think of the force as, you know, being, lines of force, like you draw for the electric field, say. But with a really strong force, those lines would be mostly going directly between the two particles and just a little bit of them straying away from that. And Nambu was thinking, well, if you wanted to build a theory of mesons, maybe they would act like little bits of string. And so he wrote down an action for string and studied the spectrum of particles that it would predict if you had something acting like string. And it didn't fit the known spectrum of mesons very well. Mesons are spin one particles, because there was a spin two particle. Well, the graviton is a spin two particle, and this led to researchers at Caltech, Shirk and Schwartz, at the time were at Caltech, and they said, well, maybe we could take this string model of Nambu's and use it as gravity theory, a fundamental gravity theory. And this was really the beginning of string theory, where what happened was, about 76 or 77, Shirk and Schwartz managed to show that that spin 2 mode of string actually at low energy gives rise to the Einstein-Hilbert action for general relativity. So that the low-order string theory really was general relativity. And there was some debate about that still into the early 80s when it was definitively shown that, you know, up to corrections of the order of the Planck length, that really was the theory of gravity that you get from string theory. People carried it to higher order and showed that there's no other junk you get. It really is general relativity. So all these things were happening, you know, string theory and supersymmetry, you know, were happening in parallel. People developed one or the other. It was really, it was getting into the 80s before people really worked on supersymmetric strings much. But by 1980, it was pretty well established, even earlier, that supersymmetry was probably the way you wanted to go. Supersymmetry had been shown to improve the properties of quantum field theories. So, you know, it's probably a good assumption that if you want to write down some unified quantum field theory, you probably want to make it supersymmetric. It does nice things to gravity. It turns out to be very hard to talk about a spin 3/2 field. But, because if you introduce the general spin 3/2 field together with the spin 2 field of general relativity, you end up with some extra constraint. There's this artificial constraint equation that just isn't in general true. But if you look at supersymmetric gravity, it automatically includes the spin 3/2 field as the super partner to the graviton, and that constraint is automatically satisfied because of the supersymmetry relation. So it looks like exactly the right way to do a spin 3/2 field, to do a what's called a supergravity theory. And people in the late 80s were already looking at supergravity theories, late 70s into the early 80s. And it was actually, 1984 that Green and Schwartz showed that if you take a, string theory. If you look at super string theory, which takes place in 10 dimensions, they found that it actually predicted an additional internal symmetry. They thought it was just SO32. In fact, Witten showed the night they told him, he stayed up and calculated and showed that it could be E8 cross E8, where E8 is one of the exceptional E groups, or SO32. But just those two choices. And that was very exciting to people doing supergravity, because it was known that superstring theory included supergravity, but now it also made a semi-unique prediction of an internal gauge group that could be used for the standard model SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 symmetry. So you actually had a prediction of an internal symmetry group. That is important because people had spent all of the 70s guessing possible internal symmetries, SU5 or SO10 or E6. There were lots of attempts to build what are called grand unified theories by just choosing a gauge group big enough to incorporate the standard particle model. People did systematic studies of groups to see what properties they would have to try and narrow down, well, you know, what are the best groups for doing these unifying pictures of fundamental physics? And string theory, as of 1984, predicted, oh, it's either E8 cross E8 or SO32, if you accept the rest of superstring theory, which people were inclined to do because supergravity was looking like the way to go for the gravity theory. Superstring theory includes supergravity and now predicts the gauge group. So at that point, it looked like an extremely productive way to go. Now, 20-some years later, it's proving very hard to know exactly how you get from 10-dimensional superstring theory to 4-dimensional predictions with the standard model. There is a great deal of systematic work going on studying exactly how that can be done. All right, you know, people look at large classes of groups and large classes of ways of compactifying 10-dimensional manifolds down to 4-dimensional space-time together with some compact internal space, some small, you know, cylinders, torized spheres, whatever, that would account satisfactorily for the other 6 dimensions. And to do that in a way that is consistent with the standard model we've observed, which turns out to be quite a restriction, because we know quite a lot about the standard model, and its parameters are pretty tightly restricted. So, you all know. You're going to make it here? Okay. Question? Where should we go? We should all go ski. There's still snowing out there. So we got plans tomorrow. Okay.
Here again.
It's the ski holiday.
Oh, man. You guys want to take a ski holiday or not? Yeah, you got to talk my quantum class into doing it too. I've promised them a problem session tomorrow.
I don't think he's gonna get that out of him. Sorry.
Yeah. They're probably gonna want to do that.
I have no idea. I'm pretty sure Chad needs it too.
Yeah. Now we'll do that. That's okay. There will still be some snow left later in the week.
Have we already seen the Navier-Kerfon equation?
No, you have not.
I wrote them down.
The Navier-Kerfon equations. They're a way of writing the Lie algebra of a Lie group. So we can write. I might have quickly written this down at one point. But a Lie algebra is basically defined by the commutation relations of the generators, and that gives us structure constants, the ABC, and giving a linear combination of the generator scan.
You did.
And then we have the Jacobi identity.
GA
with GB, G, C, and basically is 0. So you just cycle the ABC, sum 2 more terms, and set that to 0. To get the Navier-Kerfon equation, what you do is define one form, dual to the generators, So you have some sort of right, these are some one forms, omega, and the generators. Remember, the generators are moving you in a group manifold. You can think of them as vector fields that show you all the directions you can go from the identity on the manifold. So these are vector fields. So these guys are forms. All right, there's a duality between forms and vectors. All right, we require this to be contour AB, where in terms of basis forms, the dxm and d dxn, okay, we have a duality between those. And so these omegas and those g's are just some linear combinations of a coordinate basis, and so this gives some constraint on the particular linear combination. Then, in terms of the one forms of the omega A, the commutators become differential equations. The omega is minus a half, and you get the structure constant with omega B wedge omega 2. That is totally equivalent to these commutation relations. That translates directly into this. And d squared omega A identically 0 implies the Jacobi identity. So the Jacobi identity is the integrability condition for this equation. All right, integrability, remember, d squared equals 0. So so the first thing we want to do next is to rewrite the equations of the Lie algebra in this form. Then we'll look at what the quotient, taking a quotient by a subgroup, does to these equations. These are called the Maurer equations. Cartan equations. And from this, if we integrate these equations, we get back to the whole group. So we have information about the whole group. But now we're going to use these to, well, let's see. The long and short of it is, these one forms, these omega A's, those are the gauge fields. Those are precisely the gauge fields. They have, they transform automatically, they transform inhomogeneously under the group you start with, or under the subgroup if you're looking in a quotient space. So these are going to give us these gauge structures that we want automatically. When we take a quotient of the group by a subgroup, these equations will describe that quotient manifold, the manifold built as a coset. And by doing a straightforward modification of these equations, we can make that manifold curved any way we like. So, go to the next step. Yeah. Okay.
So, with this E&M example, in E&M you had d squared of omega equals 0 and d squared of omega star equals 0. Are those, does that hold, I guess it would hold here too, d squared of your original
equals
0 too, wouldn't it?
Alright, if we have the example of E&M, the group is U1. There's one generator. We can call it G. All right. It commutes with itself because there's only one of them. So the Maurer-Cartan equation, we get one dual one-form gauge field, gauge vector form field. Let's call it A. So then the Maurer-Cartan is dA equals 0. And what that means is that by the converse to the Poincaré lemma, dA equals 0 implies A is D of something, let's call it phi, is pure gauge. Okay, well, we don't necessarily want it to be pure gauge, so we modify the Maurer-Cartan to get what I call the Cartan equation. dA, instead of being 0, is going to be some two-form. And there are certain properties we require of the two-form. F must satisfy 0 equals d squared a. So we have a constraint on F. That's two of the Maxwell equations already. Right? This basically is the integrability of the Cartan equation, right? So we modify this. If we put an F here, A is no longer pure gauge. But we still have A can go to A plus D phi. Right. We can still do these transformations locally. So we've retained this structure of A being D of any function phi. Now, A can change by any function phi, and at the same time, F is unchanged. So now we build a structure that generalizes the group structure with this single generator. What we can now do is build an action out of this field. So what we do is we let the action be the integral of F star F, and we vary that and we get the Maxwell equation, the other two Maxwell equations. We can add sources for that if there's other stuff in the theory. So that's the general technique. It gets a little more involved when you don't have an abelian group like this. Simplicated. But this is really the procedure we're going to follow and the way we'll gauge any group. Now here, I've just gauged U1, so I started with a one-dimensional bundle and it's all bundle. It's over some space-time and the space-time didn't come out of the picture here. I could do the same thing but take, say, a direct product of U1 and the Poincaré group, and do the same procedure there. And I'll probably get general relativity out of it at the same time, but I will construct space-time with the U1 fiber. Or I could take a five-dimensional group. I could take four translations, space-time translations, together with U1. That's a five-dimensional group, sort of a boring abelian five-dimensional group. But if I take the quotient of that five-dimensional group by the U1 subgroup, what I get is a U1 fiber bundle over space-time, over Minkowski space. And then I would be constructing something that gave me both the manifold and the electromagnetic symmetry. And we can, you know, build up some more and more elaborate models. We'll do that. We'll work through some very simple cases and then, you know, add features. So I'll do the proofs. I'll derive the Maurer-Carton equation from the Lie algebra. I'll do that next time. Show the Jacobi identity, and then we can start looking at specific cases and look at what happens when you take quotient groups here, break it all out, and start building models. Come on, go home. You're sick. Get better.
Thank you.